Time now for another exciting program of the Better Health Radio Show. It's gone 33 seconds after 6 o'clock on this Sunday. I am Greta Stanceely, and we want to invite you to another great program. Your host this evening will be Dr. Adanna Grandison. She's got somebody lined up as usual to converse with for your benefit. So let's bring her in and wish her a very good evening. Good evening, Dr. Grandison.
Good evening, Gregson, and good evening to our listeners all across Barbados. I want to say, first of all, welcome to this very festive and Yuletide season. And I thought that this evening we would probably end our show for the year on a very solid and positive note. And so I wanted to bring this evening one of our final speakers for the year, and this is Dr. Nadia Clark. Dr. Nadia Clark is a medical doctor of 20 years experience who has a special interest in medical legal law. She spent 10 years working in the accident and emergency department at the Queen Elizabeth Hospital before moving on to private practice. She's currently in possession of an LLB degree, and now she's on her way to pursuing her legal education certificate. Good evening and welcome, Dr. Clark.
Good evening, and thank you for introducing me in that fashion.
Thank you so much, Dr. Clark, for joining us. And I really wanted to take this opportunity this evening to speak about tort and what we know as medical negligence. I know there are lots of conversations that can go on around this topic, and certainly there's a lot of misinformation sometimes in this space. And so I thought it would be best that we give some context to some of the challenges that persons may have in terms of understanding this very unique world. So I'll start off by asking the very first question out of the gate: what is really medical negligence?
Okay, so before we get into what is medical negligence, let's look at first what is a tort. A tort is any wrongful act, or this is according to the definition from Blackstone, a wrongful act or an infringement of a right other than what would be under contract, leading to a civil legal liability. So what does that mean? And for those who are listening and have legal background, I'm not calling myself an expert. I'm just stating from what I know. So this is a right in realm. What does that mean? A right in realm is a right that we hold, and we can then put that against the whole world versus a contract which is established between two or more parties who've entered into an understanding from a contractual basis, and that's a right in personam. So if I got into a contract with you, Dr. Adanna Grandison, it is against you that I would have to bring my claim rather than bring it against the whole world. Now, so that's a tort. And negligence now, when we look at negligence, is the failure to do, or maybe something that has been done, which a person who's going to be objectively seen as the reasonable man, guided upon these considerations, which ordinarily regulate the conduct of normal human affairs, would do, or on doing something that a prudent or reasonable person would not do. So what does that mean? If using the objective tests and using the objective person being the reasonable person, I fail to do something that any reasonable person out there without any legal or medical knowledge would have thought should have been done, or I did something that then even a reasonable person would say, boy, that should not have been done. And this ordinary person is just actually any of the listeners who are listening in on this program right now, who don't have any overly suspicious mind, who, you know, have a fair grasp of the English language, who you would say is reasonably educated, who actually could be found on as being a member of a jury when it comes up for jury duty.
Right.
That is negligence, is the failure to do something that either a reasonable person guided under the context of the circumstances would have done, or have done something that a reasonable person would say, boy, that should not have been done at all.
Okay. So now that you have established tort and we start to look at medical negligence, we know that within the medical fraternity, doctors owe a duty of care. Can you please explain to us and lend some clarity on what is a duty of care and how is it really established?
Okay, so to expand a little further on the tort of negligence, it's based on three elements, actually, of which one you have mentioned already. It is the duty of care that is owed by, in the case of the defendant being in the case of a doctor against which whom a claim has been brought, by the claimant who would have been at that time either the patient, him or herself, or a representative for that person if they're no longer here, as in they've died, or someone who is incapable of bringing the claim because of some infirmity. There's a breach of that duty, and then there's damage that is said to have been caused because of that breach of duty. So I'm going to break down what the duty of care is. It's important for the listeners to understand that just because a person committed a mistake or an error does not mean that they're liable for the damage that was caused. So I'm going to explain what I mean by that, but let me say that again carefully. Just because a careless act may have been committed against your person, whether it's a mistake or an error, it does not mean that you, the person who committed that, is necessarily liable for the damage that was caused. And somebody may scratch their head and say, well, what do you mean by that? Well, somebody do me say, suing them. But let's go into that a little closer. You will only be held responsible for any negligent act that was taken if you were under a legal duty to have taken such care. So, and it sounds strange, but it is true. There was a case that came up from as far back in the 19th century that, you know, a person can be negligent as he pleases to the whole world if he owes them no duty to them. So there's something called the neighbor principle. And again, those who are listening who have some legal background will understand what I mean by the neighbor principle. Because that came up in a case, Donahue and Stevens. I'm going to leave that there, but we're going to go further and say that what we're looking at is a person who's said to be in sufficient proximity. So I, as a doctor, having established a duty of care to my patient, it is said that my patient and I have an established relationship. I owe a duty of care to my patient. It is said, therefore, that anything that I do, there may be a possibility that I am going to be liable for what I have done to them. Okay? But it's not as simple as it may appear. I have to know that there was possible harm or foresee that harm could have been caused. I have to, as I established, there has to be proximity between the two parties, and it must not exceed what is the public interest. There must be the imposition of the duty must be fair, just, and reasonable. Now, going on to the main crux of the thing, what is medical negligence? This is where the, as it stands, the care or the practice of what I would have done as a doctor, I'm just using me as an example, fell below the standard of care. And how is that standard of care established? That standard of care is established by looking at someone of ordinary skill. So this means, therefore, that I can be at a certain level, being that I have basic competence to do certain things. So I don't have to go any higher and be trained to the level of being a fellow in, let's for example, ophthalmology, but if I'm in the field of ophthalmology, I must have the basic skills that all ophthalmologists must have. I'm not allowed to go below that. So that is understood, right?
Right. I wanted to pause to ask you here a very interesting question. Mm-hmm. Can a duty of care be established as an imposed duty of care, or is it something that can be assumed? Can you lend some clarity on that? Because there are several situations that you can have. For instance, you have the established patient where you have a relationship with them, and then you may have a situation where someone may present into a space unexpectedly, and you are put into action. Help us understand that concept.
Okay, so let me see if I understand what you mean. So for example, with the most common relationship between doctors and patients is in the, let's say, the general practice setting, if I am clear what you're saying. Mr. Miller comes in every 3 months to see you, Dr. Adano Grandison, and it is understood that he is your patient and you are his doctor. There is an established duty of care there. In an emergency setting, Miss Sandiford may come into your, have been brought into your GP practice, and is expected to be seen, and you've never seen her before. You don't know anything more about her than what the relatives or friends are bringing to you. That's still an implied duty of care. Once that person has come through your door, and once you have taken it upon yourself reasonably to accept this person in your establishment and have begun to treat them, it is understood that you have a duty of care to them.
Okay, great.
Now, other thing that I may touch on is where someone may call on the phone and ask a question, and they are talking, let's say it is Sherry, maybe not even on the phone, you're in the supermarket shopping, doing your thing, and the cashier recognizes that you're a doctor because she's seen you in, you know, the accident and emergency, and she decides she wants to answer some questions to get some advice as to what's going on with her, you know, intimate areas. From the time you start answering her questions, in that way, you have assumed duty of care to her, irrespective of how long you've had that conversation with, and how detailed it was. Once she is acting on the information that you have given to her, and she, and something happens as a result and she can't identify you, you're responsible. So that's why people may think I'm being rude when I don't answer their questions straight off the bat. I can't answer your questions because I don't know the context under which you're asking these questions, and you haven't given me everything. And plus two, it's personal and confidential information we should not be having in the realm of a supermarket.
Right.
So I will not accept responsibility for answering any question, no matter how innocent it appears, because it may actually put me in a very dangerous position, and so to the person.
Right.
So free advice is not actually free, because it comes with some expense later on when that person wants to say, well, look, Dr. Grandison, you told me such and such, and I went and do the thing, and now look at what happened to me.
Okay.
So that is something that persons need to understand. I know they get offended. Well, what happened? She can't answer my question. Even family members do it thinking it is okay. I think the only people who seem to understand that free advice is not free are lawyers, and that's why they're not well liked.
In terms of a breach in that duty of care, because you spoke about the three pillars upon which medical negligence is really established.
Mm-hmm.
How does one establish a breach in that duty of care?
So I will tell you some of the factors that go into that now. And remember, again, you are not required to go any higher than what is the standard for a reasonable person or professional in the field. But it's certain you're not to sink below it. So, and remember that the risk of harm must be something that is reasonably foreseeable. It can't be fantastic. It can't be something that rare and wonderful and it happens in 1 in 10 billion people, especially if it's not known in the region we're in. So what are some of the factors that you look at? You look at whether the defendant, being in this case now we're looking at medical negligence, is whether they're skilled. How skilled are they? Are they, for example, is it an intern that just come off wet behind the ears, just attained their MBBS, and they're now thrown into the deep end of the pool first night on call, and they're sweating bullets because, you know, whatever? Or are they a person that postgraduate now at the level almost consultant or consultant themselves that have at least 30, 40, 50 years experience and ought to know certain things, keeping up with their continuous medical education out there writing papers and such. So you got to look at the special characteristic of the medical professional. You've got to look at the special characteristics of the claimant, being the patient. Was this a person that was otherwise healthy and hale and nothing going on, as strong as an ox? Or was this a person that they're fragile and had a plethora of comorbidities, and you sneeze at them too hard and they fall apart like Humpty Dumpty? You have to look at the size and gravity of the risk that is presumed. Was it a risky surgery in case of surgery, and it was understood by all and sundry that this was a life and death situation and we doing this as a last resort? How practical is it to protect against the risks? And what is the common practice within the relevant field of medicine? Right? Those are the things to look at. And then again, what are the benefits to society that are to be gained from taking such risks? So again, this is where public interest comes in. Would it be reasonable to bring a case against the medical professional in a case such as this, where public interest may warrant that we do not do this because of the sensitivity of the situation that has arisen? Then we have to look at the context of what it is that is happening. And remember, all of this is on a balance of probabilities. And when I say a balance of
probabilities... Right, I was just about to ask you that, Dr. Clark. What really is a balance of probabilities? Because we hear these terms often.
In simple terms, it's like a scale. So let's say a person came in and their survivability was at less than 50. No matter what you did, you could have been, I don't need to be blasphemous on a blessed Sunday morning, you could be Archangel Gabriel. It probably was going to be nothing that could have been done to save that person, even under the best heroic efforts. It was just too far gone. So when we look at balance of probabilities, we're looking at a number of anything 50 and above to say whether or not there was a likelihood of this thing working out in the favor of maybe the claimant. Anything less than that, it would have been really anybody's guess how it would have tossed up. But again, this is where it becomes very important. How much information was given at the time of presentation of the patient? Even if in a situation where, like, it's you, Dr. Dana Grandison, and it is Mr. Miller that I am bringing up, and you've known him for years. I know this brand new thing, he has not come to you because of COVID in 2 years, but you knew him from before. I know something new is happening with him, but he has not told you everything, even though you asked all the questions. Can you be reasonably held to be liable for what has happened to him now if all the information was not known? The answer is really, on a balance of probabilities, it may work out in your favor, Dr. Daniel Grandison, that you're not going to be held liable because he withheld information from you that was valuable and essential to helping him become better, and he withheld that.
So I want to play a little bit of devil's advocate here. And what responsibility is there of the physician to try to ensure as much as possible that they get as much information? We all know that sometimes we have consultations where a patient may not initially feel comfortable. And that is a natural response. A patient comes into your practice, they may not feel comfortable initially opening up to you. And so they don't share everything with you because they're assessing you as you are assessing them. And what responsibility do you have as a physician to try to really ensure that you can really tease out some of those subtleties and really get a very holistic appreciation of your patient.
That's an interesting one. And the answer is not so simple.
Right.
If I'm working, let's look at context. If I'm working within the hospital setting where this person is known to the system, and you're recognizing that all of the pieces of the puzzle are not coming together nicely, there's access to the records, and it is your duty bound to make sure that you get all of the information you can get as you can get it, and that's where you will use other resources like records, laboratory investigations, if there's pathology, such like to get this information. Right. Sometimes you're not able to do any of that. It's just you and the patient in a private office or maybe in their home. And it is rather difficult sometimes to do, but you've got to develop that skill where you fast forward and future fate a relationship with that person as quickly as possible. And that comes with time. It's not easy to do. But you've got to make that person as comfortable as possible and explain to them as firmly but as gently as possible that the information that you give me may make a difference between you coming out of here with maybe a bruise versus coming out with a loss of a limb.
Right. Because certainly the primary role of your physician is really to give you the best possible outcome where yes. possible. Right. So I wanted to move on now to the third point, because we went through that. The first point, which is that the defendant essentially is owed a duty of care mm-hmm. and that there was an established breach in that duty. Mm-hmm. And now we move on to the third point, which is that the harm of which the person complained of was caused by that breach in the duty of care. And certainly proximity plays a role. So yes. I wanted you to really delve into that and provide us with a bit of clarity on that third point, because I think that that is probably one of the most difficult places, apart from establishing that breach, but certainly also establishing the proximity and causality associated with such.
Right. So I will confess that this was a part that when I was doing my LLB, that caused me a bit of anguish trying to get that clear in my mind. But fortunately, I love tort. I'm going to put a plug in here. There was he's now an established judge, Mr. Jefferson Karmabach, and had it not been for him really opening my eyes and allowing me to put on my tort goggles, I would have been lost. So hail to him. So causation. And when I was talking about the neighbor principle, and so it's not just mere physical proximity. It is, can it be foreseen that this that I do will cause you harm? And it is the burden of proof for that is on the claimant, the patient or the patient's representative, the patient's estate, to prove that the doctor who performed the duty not only breached the duty, but that what their breach did was the immediate operative or even proximate cause for the claimant or patient's loss or death. So therefore justifying the imposition of liability on the doctor. But there's something that's important in there called the but-for test. And so therefore it becomes important to see if there was an event that occurred that will break the chain between the duty of care, the breach of that care, and the damage that was caused. But for this thing, it brought that link between the breach and the damage, and it has to be significant. If not, it was my breach that caused the damage.
Okay.
I'm gonna give an example.
Thanks.
So for example, let's say I like using pseudonyms. So if there's anybody listening, they happen to have these last names, I do not know you, and it's just by circumstance, okay? So let's say Mr. Maynard presented to the Accident and Emergency, where he spent over 10 hours waiting to be seen because of severe abdominal pain. It is said that Dr. Ashton was the one that examined, and the wife of Mr. Maynard is claiming that Dr. Ashton did not fully and thoroughly examine the patient. In fact, he ignored what the person was saying, thought that he was exaggerating his pain scale in order to get morphine, and sent him home on Panadol and Boralgin. The man died in the night. An autopsy was done, and it was found out that actually he was a workman that was putting out fly paper, and he actually died from arsenic poisoning because he wasn't washing his hands after handling the fly paper. It could be held by the court that even if it was that the doctor was negligent, had not properly examined the patient, did not take the patient's history properly, did not confer with anybody more senior than himself to find out what could have been the cause, there was no antidote available in the hospital. So it would be but for the unavailability of the antidote and the fact that it was arsenic that caused the poisoning, the patient would have died anyway. So nothing that Dr. Ashton could or would have done, right, or that he failed to have done, was the immediate, operative, and proximate cause of Mr. Maynard's death.
Okay. So I want to switch gears a bit now. I'm going to finish off with another topic, which is a topic of consent, which I think is absolutely critical to understanding everything here. But I wanted to ask, does a standard of care also apply to alternative medicines?
Repeat that again, because you broke up a little there. So sorry, it must be my connection.
Sorry about that. Does a standard of care also apply to alternative medicine?
I am not au fait with alternative medicine, and I am always very careful not to step into realms that I am not au fait with. And the feel of alternative medicine is not without its controversy, and I don't want to step on anybody's toes.
I asked that question because certainly there is a minimal standard that is expected within the space of the medical fraternity practicing. And I know that there's lots of variability based upon research gathering within an alternative or holistic space where there one may consider there's no right or wrong, but certainly context and timing of intervention. And maybe that's where that question comes from. Can we take that same standard, or what we call the Bolam's test, and apply it in a space of alternative medicine?
That's going to be difficult to do, because until such time as the practitioners of alternative medicine come up with their own established standard of care and say, this is where the bar is.
Right.
You stay here, you don't have to go any higher, but you certainly are not to go below this. It is going to be difficult to apply Bolam's tests to this. They may actually find themselves persons who are practitioners of alternative medicine falling into the what is known as the Bolito's test, where even where there is an established practice or standard of practice, it is therefore to the court still to decide based on the context of the circumstance that is brought before the court whether or not they will find that practitioner liable or not liable. And in the case of that case, the Bolitos Bolitos case, oftentimes it doesn't go in favor of the practitioner, where they look at the standard of practice and what may have happened and the proximity and causation. All of those things play all supportive, mutually supportive roles in determining what is the liability of the defendant. Now, the interesting thing to remember is that for all medical professionals, we are autonomous in how we do what we do. So no one doctor does everything the same way. But it is understood that there is a line that has been drawn in the sand, and you must make sure that you get to that standard. Absolutely. And getting to that standard, if you go above there, then 100 points for you. If you fall below that, you recognize you're falling below that and you're doing nothing to correct your deficiencies, therein is the problem, because you're willfully being negligent in that case.
Okay, so I'm going to put a pause here because I think we have a caller. Gregson, I'm going to turn over to you at this point in time.
Very good evening. Go right ahead, sir.
Hello. Good evening. Very good evening to you. And thanks for a very interesting discussion. Two questions. In the context of negligence, where does the question whose fault come in? And to what extent is there such a thing as contributory negligence on the patient's part? Is that clear? So that's the whose fault, and then in what area or to what extent is there something called contributory negligence? If I, as patient, for example, I would have a level for having contributed to my own misfortune. Are you with me?
Yes, with you, very much so.
Dr. Kurtz, right. You want to take that question?
I'm going to try. So, yes, there is such a thing called contributory negligence. It is where there's the, as the caller just called in and stated, the patient has done something that has lent to their outcome being poor. What does that mean in terms of you're a diabetic and you've not been taking your medication? Is it that the doctor is said to be liable? No, there's always, it could be said maybe if the doctor is aware that you are non-compliant and has not done everything that is within the reasonable standard of getting you the counseling, sending you to get further education, educating you yourself about the importance of adherence to your medication. But yes, at the same time, you're an adult. And once it can be said that you are mentally competent and understand the risks of not taking your medication, it may reduce the amount of liability that the doctor has if damages are to be awarded. The doctor, at least, unfortunately, still has that overwhelming burden of responsibility towards the patient. And persons may say that that is unfair, and other medical professionals may say it is unfair, but that is the crux of the matter. As a medical professional, you have to make sure that you're doing everything to ensure that your patient understands the consequences of taking medication and of not taking the medication. Where you realize that your endeavors are failing to get the point across, it is where you need to refer them on to other specialists who are able to help them, whether it is a patient advocate, someone who advocates for diabetics and can speak to them at their level to understand where their reticences in taking maybe insulin, send them to support groups to help them to recognize that diabetes, well, it is a disease. It's one that you can live with and you can still function. You know, send them to even a psychologist if you realize that there are mental blockages to them appreciating and understanding where them their their the diabetes is concerned. And if you get all of that.
Go ahead. I'm coming after you. Give us 1 second, caller. I think something even as simple as if the patient is even unable to see, for instance, that insulin syringe well, to be able to pull up the adequate dose, certainly there's an importance to ensure that the patient as a whole is competent and in the frame that they can address the matter. So that is where we are responsible. Am I understanding you correctly?
Yes, that is where. So you have to look at all of the different factors before we can say that it is the patient's fault.
Right.
Right. It is important to know, and I see where the caller, and I'm hoping I'm correct. It is important to note that a person, so let's say a patient, is guilty of being contributory negligent if he reasonably appreciates that his careless act would lead to him being harmed. And that's difficult to say because remember, most patients are not medically trained. They don't understand all the consequences of their actions. It is the doctor who has the higher burden of responsibility in that case if he were to try to use that as a defense. And that may not be looked at favorably if all the factors that I have mentioned so far in that particular case, using diabetes as the example, have not been explored.
Caller, I heard you had another question.
Yeah, could the Learned Council go over the concept of foreseeability and to what extent
I'm not counsel yet. I'm in the making of becoming one, but thank you all the same.
Well, I trust you, succeed. But in what way can you go over the concept of foreseeability, especially when we have to look at something called remoteness of damage? In other words, are there scenarios where damage may occur, but it is too remote for you to succeed against the defendant? Are you with me?
I'm with you. But you tell me, give me an example so I know where your mind is going, and then I can see how I can answer the question to help you.
In other words, a person goes to a medical practitioner. The person goes and the medical practitioner administers treatment. Something happens. Mm-hmm. That the patient does not get what the patient bargains for, but the doctor in question, having been prima facie a peer level, may still be able to say, listen, damage has occurred, but it is too remote. I just cannot foresee how you could have suffered as a patient. It is absolutely too remote, either from the point of view of what medical practice knows about, or from any point of view of the peculiar fact situation. Are you with me?
I am with you. So you're looking at, for example, if there was an adverse side effect that was so rare that it couldn't even have been foreseen, or if it was foreseen, it was only mentioned in one journal for one set of persons at that point in time. That wouldn't... Right. So in a case like that, where it is that it is a very rare complication, yes, it could be said that it was not foreseeable. Now, remoteness now has to do with whether or not there was an established relationship between the two persons, where the defendant is whoever it is, and the claimant is whoever it is. But it is understood that where it is that there is a patient-doctor or doctor-patient relationship, there is sufficient proximity there. So we want the argument of remoteness won't come in there. So where I see what you're talking about in terms of foreseeability, could it have been foreseen that this particular adverse reaction would have occurred, especially if it was either not one that was well documented or never having been seen before? That's foreseeability. Remoteness has to do with whether a relationship could have been set up, understood prima facie between these two persons. And it's already understood under the law that doctors and patients have a close relationship. It's like a mother and a child. It's like a teacher and a student.
Can you round off the discussion, which is going very well, by telling the public about how you as a lawyer, a budding lawyer, successful one to be, but look at the question of whose fault in the context of negligence, really we look at whose fault. I think you referred to it, but I think the public would want to go back over it. So far, you're going brilliantly. You're going to get it.
Oh. Okay, thanks. You're faster me, and then my head will get too big and I'll forget the question. So it goes okay. On balance of problems. It goes on balance of probability. And at the end of the day, I will say this to all who are listening. It is really when all the facts have been taken into account and the context under which these circumstances occurred that you will determine whether or not you're for the defendant or you are against the defendant. Okay? And that's a scale. It's a...
All right, sir. I'm sorry to have to cut your conversation very short. Shorter than we've had it for a little while here. One last question you want to pose, because we've got some lights going here.
She was speaking about balance of probability. You know, this must be contrasted against beyond reasonable doubt. In certain areas of the law, proof must be beyond reasonable doubt. But in civil law practice, especially in tort and contract, you can win your case on what we call balance of probability, meaning that it need not prove it beyond reasonable doubt. Okay, that's it for me.
Yes.
Thank you.
All right, sir.
You're welcome, sir. Have a good evening.
Thank you kindly. I've got a
Gregson, we have enough.
Yeah, thank you, sir. You take care, and season's greetings to you as well. Yeah, we had a few lights going. I've got one more still going, so let's see if we can access that before they are away from us. Very good evening.
Hi, good evening.
Yes, please. The doctors can hear you. Please go right ahead.
Good evening.
Hi, good evening.
Good evening.
My son was shot, right? At about 8 o'clock in the night. And he was shot in the thigh. It went through one thigh and came through the next thigh. Well, burst in an artery and a vein. And he had to get a special surgeon to do the operation. This operation was not done until 8 o'clock the next morning. What would you say about that? Therefore, resulting in my son having to... the blood went down on his foot. So he had to get these two cuts on the outside of the chain bone, which is about 12 inches long on both sides. And then apparently something went wrong and he ended up with a sore under the bottom of his feet. I understand his foot was going dead, which wasn't told to me by the doctor on the ward at the time. I was only told that when he was home recovering and the nurse was coming to clean it every day and it started to smell stink and I inquired because I thought it was a bed sore that he had gotten. But then she told me no, that it was a result of not having something went wrong and it was dying. If they didn't tell me that, my son would have lost his foot.
Okay. So thanks very much for the question, but I am actually gonna take that question out of the hands of Dr. Clark, because we are getting information here. I don't think the radio show really would allow you to give full context of the matter. And to be able to give you the best possible answer, I think you need more of a one-on-one consultation with a legal specialist in a situation like that. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't ask Dr. Clark to answer that question on the air.
Yeah, I understand.
And I will ask if it is possible that with a legal consultant and probably their medical advisor in a situation like that. Okay?
Okay. Does anyone thank you recommend?
At this point in time, no, but I know that we do have a good few civil lawyers on island, and that would be on a civil setting that you would be looking for.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you for your call.
You're welcome.
You have a good evening. Was just about to access the other one. Ah, here we go. It's back. So let's try. You ready for another one, Dr. Grandison?
Sure, absolutely.
All right. Let's see if we can access this one here very quickly. Very good evening to you.
Good evening.
Hello. Seems like they're gone. All right. Go ahead, Dr. Grandison.
Sure. So, Dr. Clark, I wanted to switch gears a bit because when we talk about a duty of care and intervening and providing medical attention and treatment, there is something that we definitely need to establish. Certainly, touching a patient without a patient, and we've heard this here going through the entire medical school, and I'm sure you are now even faced with it more and more as you are on your legal journey. Touching a patient, providing treatment to a patient without consent, and I would go even further and say without adequate and appropriate consent, can be likened to causing that patient harm and could be considered battery or assault. Can you please really explain to us how does a physician go about establishing consent and gaining consent, and what are some of the very absolutely critical things that must be a part of that consent?
Okay. So for the listening audience, there is a duty on the part of the doctor, and if it's a doctor within the hospital setting, to obtain consent of a patient. What's consent? Consent in simple terms is where I agree to the procedure that you're going to do to me. It could be as simple as allowing for a history to be taken, to as much as having my abdomen opened up and to be explored to save my life. The only situation where consent may be understood not to have been taken expressly is in the case of a dire emergency, and where there is no one else in the whole world that is connected with this person that is before you proceed with the procedure that you have to do.
Dr. Clark, I want to put a pause right there because I can see that Gregson is actually flagging us for a call, and I don't want that. We probably missed that caller that's trying to ask a question. Mm-hmm.
Yes, hi, good evening. Great evening to you. I'm very sorry for that. Just on my line was, like, you couldn't hear me from my cell phone. I'm calling from a different line now, and I want to thank you. Good evening. God bless you. And I just have a quick question, Dr. Grandison. Can another doctor have negligence based on something that they have basically no knowledge about, like when we had the new virus the other day, which the whole world now knows about? So I'm asking if at that time could that be negligent? Could you claim it at me as a patient coming to you about a new virus in my body that has presented in my body that you don't know about because it's new? Thank you, novel. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Clark. I think I can answer that, but I am not the legal expert here or the more legally knowledgeable person. But I think Dr. Clark would have mentioned that before when she stated about the establishment of a certain standard or it is known within the context. But Dr. Clark, I'm going to let you take that away from there.
Well, from what the caller may be alluding to, it strikes or goes to what I was saying earlier when knowing the information that you know at the particular point in time. How much information did you know? And if this is said to be brand new, could we necessarily say that the lack of knowledge meant that the person was negligent? It may be difficult to say so. But working on the information that they have, if they recognize that they're dealing with something brand new, it is for them to reach out to an established body. For example, PAHO, WHO, and say, look, I think I'm dealing with something here brand new, and I want somebody to let me know. So first you will deal with your local body that's associated with, like, maybe, like, for example, PAHO, and they may reach out and say, well, let's get the information and let's see what's going on. If time is of the essence, or maybe if the person has already died, and let's see if this is something that was known from before, if it's something, as I say, that is now de novo coming out from, you know, and everybody has to look into what is going on here. I don't know if I have answered the person's question. I hope so.
Yes, Dr. Clark, thank you very much. So you're saying that based on the pandemic that we just went through, based on this millions of death crisis, you're saying that as a doctor, I would have been held negligent based on the fact of the knowledge that I know now that I didn't know at the time, because we now know about the virus.
No, that
would have happened.
No, never said that. That's where now I would say that you're guilty of doing something that I don't even allow my mother to do. That's the words in my mouth.
Sorry for that.
I said to you, no problem. I've said to you that to establish any sort of negligence, and let's go thing, is to say this. How much knowledge was known at the time, at that particular time when the situation arose? Okay?
Mm-hmm.
The point that can be made on the other side is having that the alleged defendant now is saying that not know what they knew at the time. I'm just looking at what the other side may say. Did they make or avail of themselves to reach out to a body of experts who may be more knowledgeable?
Yeah.
But same thing is, if this is something that is completely new and you're dealing with a critical situation, time may have been of the essence at that time.
Well,
may not have the luxury of reaching out. I would find it a little difficult, but again, it is really for the court to decide, because given all of the information that is known at the time, can I go back retroactively and hold you for what? No, you time, I don't know if that can be done. Now, someone who is, of course, who is an established legal counsel who deals with malpractice and such like, can come the air and say to me what is the correct thing if they agree with what I'm saying. I am not sure. I have stated that I have special interest and in the process, and still I'm learning. You understand?
But I do.
Right. So I won't be able to say that it could be 15 years from now that someone could look back at something at this present point in time, given that that was the established practice, and say that, you know, let's say like the 18th century, people use leeches to draw off bad blood. Now we are in how many centuries later we would look at those persons and that was what they worked with, what they knew.
Yes, they used to use leeches. They used to use the leech, that particular animal. To I know we have all of the wonderful technology. So based on what you said, it is perfectly correct. And I thank you and have a blessed evening. God bless you.
Thank you so much.
Good
evening. So I go back now, Dr. Clark, to answer you that question of consent. You were speaking about consent, and certainly that is something that I know it probably will take more than 7 minutes, but we will try to really knock off as much about establishing consent and what are the critical components of informed consent.
Okay, so there are different ways that consent can be given. So we'll just go quickly on what those are. Okay. Is express consent. What do I mean by express? That doesn't mean fast. It means in terms of I express, I verbalize, or I write down that I have given consent. Implied consent is by the person's behavior. I come into a room, I give my name, I'm in the absence and emergency, I allow you to know that, well, such and such, and I'm going to take blood from you, and you say, okay, doc, and you put out your hand. You've implied that you are going to allow for me to puncture your vein and take blood from you for testing.
Right.
So tacit consent is where it is implied consent, understood without having been stated. So I come, you understand, since you're in the room, to be seen in room, let's say 8, of the accident and emergency. That's back when I was there. And I allow you to, you allow me to take a history, and I'm now coming to examine, and you start to take off your clothes and such, like, I understand that you understand that I'm coming to examine you.
But right? is there still a duty for that doctor to gain consent at that point? Okay, good.
You still need to, but it is understood. Once I see you doing these things, I understand. I will now verbalize you. I am going to be examining you, and you will tell me, yes, doc. But if you change your mind halfway and decide I no longer feel comfortable and put back on your clothes, it's not for me to say at that point, But we just, you know, you got to continue the examination. It doesn't work like that. Once a person says no, no means no.
Right. And so a patient can't opt out at any point in time.
They can opt out at any time. And I understand that under another context that no means no will mean something different. But between the doctor and the patient, that is as intimate as that other scenario that we won't draw reference to at this point, but people could read between the lines and understand no means
no. Understood. And so right? you were going on to speak about what are the components of providing a patient with informed consent.
So in terms of informed consent, the importance of that, what was the importance of informed consent? This is where the person, having agreed to whatever procedure, whether it's minor or major, understands both what it means are the ramifications of agreeing to the procedure and what it would mean if they decide that they no longer want the procedure.
Right.
Right? The first thing that must be established by the medical practitioner is if this person is mentally competent. They have to look, therefore, at whether or not this person, in terms of their competence, is it stable? Is it a soft undulating wave? Or is it that they fluctuate so sharply that from 6 o'clock in the morning till 10 o'clock in the evening, 1 minute they're able to say who they are, where they live, what their telephone next of kin, who's the Prime Minister of Barbados, what's the date, month, year. And now they're telling you they're the Queen of England and that they've come to rule the world. Well, is this a person that we can say is mentally competent? Where you're concerned about a person's mental competence, this is where you will have other experts come in to help you to make that decision. You have to look at the age of the person that you are asking consent of. Minors usually established cannot give consent. Okay. That, of course, comes along and it's like from the age of 16, it may be said that they're close to that age of approaching adulthood and can give consent. Right. It is therefore then that if you're dealing with a minor, you have to make sure that it is the parents that understand. Now, if you're dealing with, there are special circumstances where you have minors who may be seemingly more mature than the average. But in any case, you still have to look at something called life experience and where their influence is coming from that is helping to guide them or shape their ability to give the consent or not give consent at that time. Wherever, as a medical practitioner, you're not comfortable with what it is that you're getting as the connect between the patient and you, is where you should call in another colleague. There's no shame in the game in not being comfortable or realizing that I'm here in this realm and I'm really not certain how to proceed here.
All right. In terms of benefit versus risk, how important is that really to establish and to ensure that the patient really understands the benefit versus the risk? Because for instance, we may speak to a particular intervention that may be deemed by the medical team necessary, and we may state all of the benefits or most of the benefits because we appreciate that in performing this intervention, the patient should have a successful outcome. However, there are always risks associated with any procedure. Is it equally as important to highlight to the patient those risks and then allow the patient to make an informed decision? Or because we know that this would be in the best patient's interest, and I'm being devil's advocate, that we provide the benefits, sometimes minimizing the risks that may be involved.
Ah, I understand. So I'm going to tread lightly here, really. And anybody who really knows my personality will say that that seems almost impossible for me to tread light. But I'm going to tread light here. But I'm going to say this. At all times with patients, you need to make sure that they understand what the apples and the oranges are. It may be beneficial to myself as the doctor because I'm the doctor, I'm the surgeon, I'm the ophthalmologist, I'm whatever it is. I want you to get better. So I barreling full speed ahead. I want to do the same. I all excited about doing it for you. But it is very important that persons, and we need to have that understanding in our mind as medical practitioners, that persons are educated, and if they're not educated about a thing now, they can get educated about it very quickly if they recognize that it's in their best interest to be educated about it. And this is no longer back in the time of where you take on a paternalistic role and say, because I say so, this is how it is done. Because if something happens at the same time, the patient can easily say, well, you didn't tell me that. And remember, well, I am the one performing the procedure. It's them that have to live with it. So I would think that you should lay out to them what it is. And if time allows, I can, they're alternatives. They're always alternatives. And we all know that as medical practitioners, that there are just certain persons, and I'm going to tread lightly here, that if they ask for the ability to discuss and to see and weigh the options, we will allow them to do so. And there are others that we may think that we need to push and hold them by the hand and drag them towards the finish line. So I think we should make sure that with all patients, irrespective of which walk of life they come from, that we give them, we treat them like if they're the multimillionaire and not like the vagrant on the street, if you get my meaning.
Absolutely. I want to ask one last question. The person slipped it in. I'm asking for permission, Gregson, to ask this very last question.
Go right ahead.
The listener said, can we ask Dr. Clark about patients who perceive risk in delays? All delays are not necessarily causing any risk, but others might. Example, a patient with a cancer diagnosis who gets a first appointment in the hospital within 2 weeks. Can you lend some clarity on that? Is it that all delays actually cause harm? Or do we also know that there are some scenarios where the patient already has very questionable or unfavorable possible outcomes, and so either the case must be treated with a certain level of urgency, or for instance, if the earliest availability would suffice in a situation like that, provided that all attempts are made to put that patient's make that patient's care a priority.
So this is where context comes in. And I'm going to speak to what I, as a person who's worked in the public care system, I'm now working in the private care system. The public care system as it is fraught with deficiencies, some of makings that probably could be rectified and some that cannot be, that have been there from since Adam was a lad. You remember, and I need for the callers to be cognizant of that, We are a densely populated country with one tertiary system, one tertiary institution that must service the whole of the island, whether rich, poor, black or white, green with purple stripes and pink polka dots. Everybody's case will be seen by them as an urgency. How do I fit in all these persons so as to be able to see them in a fashion that everybody isn't there at the door being bottlenecked? Me scheduling must be done. And sometimes you're going to be first, and then sometimes you may be last. What I believe happens in situations where a appointment is given, at least from what I remember, and it is recognized that there's going to be a delay, there's always a window of being able to come in when you think that there is a problem. There's an open door policy as much as they can allow, where if you have an issue within the time frame, let's say it is 2 weeks, 3 weeks, a month, 6 weeks, you can come in or you can call, especially if they recognize that this is something that can change quite quickly. If you, and this is where patients themselves have to advocate for themselves. If you recognize that your situation, and when I say advocate, that does not mean being loud, boisterous and obnoxious with it. It means being able to quietly and firmly say, I wish to get something sooner than that. Sometimes it only is but required, but the question to be asked, and if it is asked in a way, the doctor, if they recognize the earnest of what how you are putting it, believe you me, they're not made of stone. They will try to see what they can do. I've seen a doctor who begged for a person to be squeezed on a list. They've had arguments with their consultants in order to get you squeezed on. The problem is as a previous caller would have made, is when you decide you ain't keeping the appointment call, you just didn't want to go. You when you do that, it means that you push somebody out. Mm-hmm. And so Bajans, I'm going to put this here, needs to understand that we are dealing in a limited resource environment. And so while, yes, delays are not appreciated, they're sometimes unavoidable. And in a case where something adverse happens while there is a delay, it'll be hard pressed for the court to say, especially when they recognize that all has been done that could reasonably have been done. Remember, the word is reasonable, for the court to find the practitioner negligent, especially if it is outside the scope of their responsibility.
Well, Dr. Clark, I want to say thank you very much. I think that this evening's session, based upon some of the feedback that I'm seeing, has been very well accepted. I actually just got a comment saying we need a part two to this. So I want to say thank you very much, Dr. Clark, for taking the time out to come in. Maybe we could attempt to get more of a panel discussion another time with someone who may not have so much of a medical inclination, but more on the legal side, more of probably a more seasoned medical legal expert to come in there as well. We will give it a thought. Certainly 2023 is a year of possibilities. I want to say thank you very much for coming out this evening and really educating our public on one of these topics that usually causes a lot of unease and unrest at times. I want to say thank you, Gregson. I want to say thank you to you as well for assisting us in studio. And last but certainly not least, to all of our listeners across Barbados, I want to take this opportunity to say thank you for listening in. And I want to wish you a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. And the next time that we will be talking to you, you will be hearing from us, will be the week, certainly, of January 15th. So the next time we're going to be back out on air would be January 15th, as we pause at this moment to enjoy the festive season. Thank you so much, Dr. Clark. And I'll hand back over to you, Gregson.
Okay, well, Dr. Clark, Nadia Clark, and Dr. Adana Grandison, those were the voices you were hearing. on this final edition of the Better Health Radio Show for 2022, as Dr. Gwenderson said. Listen for us, God's willing, on January 15th when we come back and resume the Better Health Radio Show. So a big thank you to both of you, especially Dr. Gwenderson. She comes around along with Dr. Lewis and takes care of you on Sunday evenings at 6. Merry Christmas to all of you and have a wonderful evening, doctors, all right? Okay, just about...
thank you.
You are very welcome. You take care and have a good evening.